This is Amber Ray.
And Rusty Tanton.
And you're listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network, the show focused on all things Atlanta and sometimes elsewhere.
It's December 20th, and we're going to do our first movie review podcast in 13 months.
Unless you count the porn reviews that we did in the previous podcast.
Yeah, I don't know if I count Three Blowing Me and...
Screw My Wife, Please, and Make It an Orgy.
I don't know if I count that as an actual movie review podcast. The last movie review podcast we did was, what, November 24th, 2006?
Yeah, and it was Jesus Camp and Short Bus.
Yes. Little juxtaposition there in that podcast. We like to do juxtapositions in the podcast, and we have another... Well, this isn't exactly a juxtaposition.
No, it's
actually kind of like a common theme.
Yeah, like sort of a theme that you might not recognize at first, but the theme here is something along the lines of movies that were meant to be one thing that was all nice and innocent or whatever, and then ended up being
something
not
quite as nice
and had a lot of stuff happen.
And sort of like conflicting values, conflicting themes. And I hate that word values normally, but I think it kind of applies here. Anyway, our two movies for this movie review podcast are Song of the South, the Walt Disney movie, and Gimme Shelter, the Rolling Stones concert film. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Song of the South?
I do want to.
Do you want to?
So Song of the South is one of those movies that kind of got a lot of hype built up around it over the years. Not hype, but maybe like lore, I guess, is the word. Because you can't buy it in the U.S. anymore. And is that right?
As of now, there is a movement underway to get it for sale on U.S. shelves again, but it's...
So you see, it's a film that has a movement.
It has a movement behind it, yes.
So you can't buy it in the U.S., and it's never shown... It's never included with any Disney compilations or anything like
that. They do show it in theaters occasionally, like once a decade or something.
Yeah, and it's...
I mean, not very often.
I mean, and it's an anomaly, but like Disney won't include it with anything other than they'll include like a snippet here and there maybe, but never the whole thing. And yet, it's kind of worked its way into the general imagination. Because everybody knows that song, Zippity Doodah. Everybody sings that
everybody
when they're a kid.
That.
But, and then if you ask somebody, where does that come from? I don't know if they'd be able to tell you where exactly. They'd probably say, they might say it's from Disney. But if you're really pressed, I don't know if they'd be able to tell you, like, what movie.
Tell you the truth, before I saw it, or before we had our interview with the Wren's Nest and I did a little research beforehand, I didn't know that.
I mean, I didn't know it until... a few years ago, I guess. But that song is from Song of the South, and it won like a best song or something.
Yeah.
For that year. But basically, I heard about the whole Song of the South thing and how it had all this lore and everything a few years ago, and I got kind of interested in it, and I did as much research as I could. And then I forgot about it.
Promptly forgot
and
about
then,
it.
Like, I was all focused on it and delving in to find as much as I could for, like, a night, like I do. And then I forgot about it. But then when we were talking to Lane at the Wren's Nest, it came up because Song of the South is based on the Uncle Remus stories, which is Joel Chandler Harris's version of the traditional African-American stories that were passed down through the generations that he wrote down. So this movie is like the Disney-fied weird version of that. What did you think of the movie?
What did I think of the movie? Oh, God, you know.
And here's the thing.
I don't even know where to start.
I should say more other than just saying that it's the Disney-fied version of Uncle Remus, because it's more than that. Like, it's more than just the Brer Rabbit stories. There are a few of those in there that are in cartoon form And, you know, most kids know the Br'er Rabbit stories in some form.
One example of a Br'er Rabbit story.
The Tar Baby story.
Tar Baby story.
And the Don't Throw Me Into the Briar Patch, which is part of the Tar Baby story.
Yeah.
But the movie, it's kind of long. And it has this whole other live action story built around it. And, I mean, it was kind of revolutionary because it was, if not the first, then one of the first movies to mix live action and cartoons.
Well, you remember in the, everybody, I'm not going to say everybody, but I'm sure many of you remember Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and I know Amber does not like that movie.
No.
You really don't like that movie, in fact. I grew up with it, I happen to like it, but it's, everybody was freaking out about how neat that was, and how neat it was that the weasels and Roger and all that were mixed in with Bob Hoskins. And all the other live-action characters. Well, they did this back in 1946. And to me, that's, from a special effects perspective at least,
it must have taken
pretty
forever.
Impressive. I mean, they had to do cell animation on top of film, and that's just kind of mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, I really wonder what that process was like.
I mean, say what you want about Disney, but those were some smart, talented people.
Yeah. So that is how the movie is structured. And this whole story, it's kind of like there's this little boy. Oh, it's set before the Civil War, right?
I think so.
Yeah, before the Civil War. And there's this little boy, and his parents take him out to visit his grandmother who lives on a plantation. And there's like this weird thing where the parents are separating. The dad is going back to Atlanta where he writes for a newspaper, and he's very controversial apparently, and he's separating from the mom. But like at first I thought it was that they were having, you know, problems, they were fighting or something, but they were trying to shield it from the little boy. But then it seemed like no, they don't want to separate, but something about I don't know.
Yeah, honestly, it was kind of gibberish to me. I mean, the for all the other controversy and whatever else surrounding this film, that was the weirdest part about it to me, was this plot that just was nonsensical and didn't really matter ultimately.
And I mean, I shouldn't get hung up on that because it's just a device to get the dad out of the picture and then bring him back at the end, I guess. But I did get
but
hung
it was
up.
Kind of a crappy device.
Why is the dad gone?
I mean, and I don't know. I just didn't. It wasn't explained very well, and even if it had been explained very well, I don't think it was all that great a device.
So, basically, to get to the point quicker, hopefully, the little boy, there's all these parallels between the Br'er Rabbit stories and the little boy's life. He meets this old slave who is Uncle Remus, who starts telling him the Br'er Rabbit stories, and he learns from them, and he applies the lessons that he learns to his life.
Yes.
And there's a tragedy at the end, and everybody is very concerned, but of course in the end it works out okay and everybody lives happily ever after. White people in the plantation house and slaves as slaves.
Yes.
That's what happily ever after is in that movie.
So back when we interviewed Lane in the Wren's Nest podcast, one of the things we talked about with Joel Chandler Harris is there were always these sort of conflicting ideas of what he stood for, I guess. I don't know if that's exactly the way to say it, but whatever his ideals were, and there was on the one hand all of this desire for African Americans to be able to read and to do all these other things, kind of a progressive standpoint with that kind of thing. And then also this kind of happy slave part of it, which, I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's just one of those contradictions that might just be indicative of the time period.
Yeah.
As for Joel Chandler Harris, I mean, I don't know. That's pretty much all I can say. But for the movie, I mean, I don't think the movie had any grand plans of trying to portray equality or anything. I just think that it was kind of a boneheaded idea all around, but they thought it was a good idea because they didn't think about that stuff or something. I don't know. But
I guess it was indicative. But, you know, okay, so here's where those countercurrents come in, though, is that the lead actor in the movie, I mean, that was the first time that any African-American had ever been the lead in a major studio motion picture like that, right?
Yes, and the counter to that is he couldn't go to the movie premiere because the city and the theaters were so racially segregated.
Yeah, and do you blame that on Disney or do you blame that on Atlanta?
I blame that on society.
Society. Well, here's the thing. If it had debuted in a different city, do you think he would have been able to attend?
I don't know.
I mean, it was kind of messed up.
You have to ask somebody who lived in the 40s. Yeah, I don't know.
I didn't live in the 40s.
But, so I think that in addition to the problems with the movie itself and the, you know, really unfortunate racial stereotypes in it, there's also all the stuff surrounding the movie. You know, all the stuff about how he couldn't go to the movie premiere because of the segregation, all this stuff that really kind of brought the segregation of the cities to the forefront. So, I mean, I don't know. It's weird. I mean, the movie was okay from the standpoint of, you know, does the plot make sense except for the part about the dad?
Yeah.
And there's a little girl in it who is really cute.
Those little boys, she had some little boys that bullied her who were just
her brothers.
Like, psychotic.
Yeah.
They were, what, going to like kill cats or something?
They were going to drown her puppy.
Drown her puppy, that's right. The puppy was cute too. The songs were catchy.
Yeah. And the animation was cool.
And the lead actor, he was, I mean, all things considered, he was great.
Yeah, he was awesome.
What is his name? Do you remember?
James Baskett, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
So, in conclusion about Song of the South, it's weird.
It's weird.
And it's not just a weird movie, but it's a weird phenomenon because there's all that stuff surrounding it.
I don't know. I almost think you kind of have to read up on it before you even watch it.
Yeah.
Just to sort of put it in context.
I agree, but on the other hand, I think it would also be interesting to hear from somebody who just knew absolutely nothing about it.
And just turned it on and watched. Yeah, there's that too.
If you've seen it, let us know what you think.
Okay.
Next movie.
Do we want to tell them the voicemail number so they can let us know? Yes. Let's tell them the voicemail number. It is 678-389-9441. Next movie. Gimme Shelter, made in 1970. It's a Rolling Stones concert film, or ostensibly that's what it was going to be. The plan from the how do you pronounce their names? The Maisels?
I don't know.
Well, however you pronounce their names. The directors of the movie had planned to follow the Rolling Stones around on their 1969 tour and to just make a generic concert film. A little bit of trivia, George Lucas was actually on the staff of this film doing something or other. But the basic premise was it was going to be a concert film, but then it turned out that this Altamont concert, which was near the end of the tour, turned out to be this really horrific kind of, here's a cliche alert, watershed event for really everything in the 60s. I mean, the 60s as an entity, not as a decade. So, what did you think?
I thought it was weird because, I mean, weird and interesting, I guess, because it was a really early example of the kind of thing that we see a lot more of now, where people just are in the moment of something big happening, like, you know, something going down, and somebody happens to be there with a camera and they catch it and document it right then. That's a really early example of it, and I mean, as far as I know, it wasn't something that had happened much at all prior to that.
So the real tragedy surrounding this Altamont concert, which was out in, what, San Francisco, I believe?
Somewhere out there.
Is they had this massive event that they knew that 300,000 people were going to show up to.
Which is a stupid idea in the first place.
Which, just having 300,000 people show up to anything seems like a dumb idea.
And why would you have a free Rolling Stones concert?
And it was a free concert. And here's the thing, they had a venue set up for it, and they had been doing all sorts of prep work for like 2 weeks in advance. They had all these plans in place, and then they had to change a location. And at that point, when the location fell through, they should have just canceled the concert. But what did they do instead? They kept it going at a new location, and they only had a few days to set this whole thing up where 300,000 people were going to show up. And not just 300,000 people, 300,000 kids who were fucked up on God knows what. And, you know, nothing against that. I did plenty of that myself back in the day, but...
Well, in the middle of 300,000 people who are doing it, that is nowhere I want to be.
Yeah. So, point being, there was no security prepared. The stage was only 3 or 4 feet off the ground or whatever it was. It wasn't very high.
And the audience could be, like, right up on it.
And, you know, and there were no plans in place for moving lanes or anything like that, for any sort of structured security. The security, get this shit, was the Hell's Angels.
And they paid them in beer.
So they got the security drunk. And they were a bunch of mean Hell's Angels.
Anybody with half a brain should be able to tell you that that is a disaster just waiting to happen.
So, yeah, what ended up happening was the predicted disaster. And I think what's so fascinating about this film is, like Amber was talking about, how you catch some shit going down right in the moment. And this was some shit. I mean,
it was just... A guy got stabbed.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately a guy got stabbed, and that's kind of...
And he died, right?
Yeah, I think he did.
But he died, and then there might have been somebody else that died. I don't remember what they were saying on the radio clips.
There are some stats. You can look it up. But that's not really what's important. What's really important is that the whole thing was just a total clusterfuck, and it's on film, and people were stabbed and beat up and brutalized, and there was just this ominous vibe about the whole thing. And really, I guess... a lot of the people who were in the film were talking about how well Woodstock went and all these hippie ideals and how people could coexist. And that's even part of how they marketed the whole thing, was people being able to coexist. And so I guess relating that to Song of the South, you know, it's another instance where you just think something is a good idea and it turns out to be a total clusterfuck.
Yeah. I wonder if Woodstock was better planned in advance.
Well, they also had to move locations, as I recall. I mean, I think they had to move locations like 2 or 3 times, but I also think they had more time to set up.
They also didn't have the Hell's Angels as security paid in beer.
Who, you know, from the opening acts, from when Jefferson Airplane was up there, I mean, they actually beat up one of the band members.
That was fucked up.
Yeah, and so you've got Grace Slick standing up there on the stage being like, yeah, we don't have to fight.
Yeah, it was really uncomfortable.
And I guess what was just, just looking at the camera angles, because they had cameras right on stage and you could just see this teeming mass of bodies just trying to get up on the stage. And that was one thing that some of the people in the film and in the excellent, excellent radio commentary we listened to that was on the DVD afterward, is the stage was only 3 or 4 feet high, whereas at Woodstock it was like, you know, 8 or 10 feet high or something much higher, high enough that it prevented people from trying to get up on the stage, which I think that by itself made a huge difference. I mean, even you could take the Hell's Angels, you could keep them there, and I still think you wouldn't have nearly as many problems as you had if that stage had just been about twice as tall as it was.
Yeah.
I mean, very simple thing, but that's the kind of thing that gets lost when you plan something in 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's definitely worth watching, but it's not something that's necessarily going to make you feel better about humanity in general.
It's something weird because I'd never heard about it before this.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder why it's not better known, or maybe it is well known and I've just been living under a rock.
It's pretty well known to anybody who's taken a film 101 class, basically.
I have not.
Yeah, so... It's the kind of thing that if you have a film club in college, it's shown it at some point.
Okay.
Well,
it was definitely interesting.
Because it's one of those things, is, you know, talking about how Woodstock was full of the ideals, people who are really idealistic and all that. I mean, you really could kind of point to this and say, well, this is, you could actually say it's on film when the 60s died. I mean, because it kind of is, because a lot of that idealism kind of crashed down right on film right here. So, anyway...
If any of y'all have seen it and have thoughts, let us know.
Please share.
So I guess that's it. We will have one more podcast during 2007 after this one. We're going to have an end of the year podcast just like we did last year. And if anybody has any ideas, just call us or email us. I mean, it's pretty much just going to be a big hodgepodge of all different things, year in review and whatever else. But if you have anything you want to say to be played in the podcast, you can call and leave a voicemail. And if you have any questions or comments or anything else, just get them to us.
Yeah, so email is info@gapodcastnetwork.com. Phone number, again, is 678-389-9441. Oh, and by the way, just as we were about to shut this whole thing down, I had put out a question on Twitter if anybody had anything to say about either of these movies, and Jen Brock tweets in that Gimme Shelter is a great road trip song.
I beg to differ, but we will agree to disagree.
I'll edit in a little bit of it later so you can hear a little.
All right, that's it. See y'all.
Without a song, jump right out of it. Zip-a-dee-doo-dah, zip-a-dee-ay. My, oh my, what a wonderful day. Plenty of sunshine heading my way. Zip-a-dee-doo-dah, zip-a-dee-ay. Mr. Bluebird's on my shoulder. It's the truth. It's actual. Everything is satisfactory. Zip-a-dee-doo-dah, zip-a-dee-ay. Wonderful feeling, wonderful day. Yes, sir. Zip-a-dee-doo-dah.
The song you heard in this podcast was Flux by Drop Trio, available only on Magnatune.com.
Thanks for listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network. Visit us at gapodcastnetwork.com. If you have a question, comment, or drunken rant, leave us a voicemail by calling 678-389-9441. Who knows, it might be featured in a podcast. You can also email us at info@gapodcastnetwork.com.